Good morning. It's Sunday, March 27th, week after Purim. crazy week. Continuing the politics of exclusion with Rabbi Akiva Eiger, following along in the order of Adam Furtzinger's book of exclusion and hierarchy. It's an interesting structure in this particular chapter because he calls it the age of the Chassam Sofer. He begins with the Chassam Sofer and then continues with Rabbi Akiva Eiger, even though Rabbi Akiva Eiger was his father-in-law. And yeah, I think he does it because one of the things that he tries to set up is something that we've seen dating back to the rabbinic period. We saw a little bit in Rambam. When you're talking about exclusion in Judaism, there are really a couple of ways you can exclude someone. You can say that so-and-so is treated like a non-Jew entirely, or they're somehow beyond the pale, but they're still part of Judaism. We saw Chassam Sofer make some of those nuances in their own right. Rabbi Akiva Eiger seemed to have been a little bit more lenient, all things considered, even though he is viewed in his own right as an opposition to Reform, because in many of the traditional rabbis, you know, you could argue might have been, but he did not take as extreme positions that the Chassam Sofer did. And we'll see some of the nuances that Rabbi Akiva Eiger held. One of the things I do like including here I have a cousin who married the ninth generation descendant of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And at the bris of their first son, they named the kid Akiva, 10th generation. And what I found so absolutely amusing about this is my cousin did a PhD in Bible at NYU, which meant she studied at some point, you know, hardcore biblical criticism. And the 10th generation grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you know, is the son of someone with a PhD in Bible. I found this absolutely hilarious. I still find it funny. My cousin's husband didn't find it as amusing as I did, but I don't care. I still think it's hilarious. Just a slight little segue there. But the truth is, you know, when we see a little bit about the biography here and also some of the positions that he took, it doesn't necessarily have to be an either-or proposition. We'll see some of the assumptions that he made, and we'll see that he was willing to cut a little bit more slack than the Chassam Sofer, and it'll lead to some, I think, very interesting discussions here, particularly with the contrast. So just first going through the very, very brief bibliography, Rabbi Akiva Eiger lived from 1761 to 1837, born in Eisenstadt, in Hungary, now Austria. You know, usual thing about child prodigy, lineage, etc. Changed his name. Anything else interesting here? Yeah, we can read on your own. Feel free to read up the biography of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Let's continue with the text and the context of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. Let's go out of order. Dan, start off with source number one here.
Eiger's efforts to uphold tradition against the dangers of the modern world differed from those of his famous son-in-law, the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer's rejectionist approach to modern ideas in political and religious change was characterized by his popularization of the rabbinic statement, "All that is new is biblically forbidden."
Now stop there for a second, because even last week we saw that he didn't say everything that was new, but this is how he's characterized, very general position. Particularly with the beards, was some of the exception. He said, well, yeah, people have beards, but, you know, just because you shave doesn't mean you're a bad Jew. Like, there were certain types of deviations from Jewish culture that he was okay with. But we tend to ascribe to him Chadash Asur Min HaTorah as sort of a catch-all for everything else that he said. Yeah.
I thought I asked you, but I don't remember an answer. Maybe I didn't ask. Why does he use such a contorted interpretation of the biblical verse when he could have said Lo Tosifu?
Chadash Asur Min HaTorah doesn't mean, I mean, Lo Tosifu means you can't add, Lo Tosifu Lava Lo Tigra Mimenu, do not, or Lo Tigras, do not subtract. When he uses the idiom of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, it's not a biblical idiom, it's a rabbinic idiom, and it refers to new grains, or at least the prohibition. The reason why he used, I would guess, and you know, I think what makes the most sense is Chadash Asur Min HaTorah doesn't mean that you're adding something new. It doesn't mean you're taking away. It means you're changing how things are done. Meaning, let's say, here's a good example. Tashlich, even though he wouldn't use that. My father likes using this as a good example of an innovative minhag, right? For quite a long period in Jewish history, Tashlich didn't exist. And then someone came up with this idea of, you know, let's read a couple of verses and let's throw our sins in the water. Some just metaphorically, others would, you know, start throwing bread or rocks. You know, and that's kind of become acceptable in many cultures, though some people still don't like it. That is a chidush. That is something new. That's an innovation. Not every change that you do in a synagogue or ritualistic practice violates Jewish law. Right? You can have custom, but customs can change. Certainly a minhag hamakom can change. And I think minhag hamakom changes a lot more than people would like to admit. Case in point, like you go to, say, Bialystoker. You know, they recently had a big deal this past summer about whether or not women can serve on the board. One of the reasons, one of the rationales for opposition given was it would represent a deviation in how the shul operates or runs things, right? So that was considered a legitimate deviation. However, when they added a little curtain on the balcony mechitza, that was also a change to the shul, but that one wasn't considered a change. Or raising a mechitza is a change to the physicality of the shul, but that is a change that people are okay with, whereas other changes people are not. The reason why I think he uses chadasha ser min haTorah is more an issue of against innovation. Even if you can't put your finger on a specific prohibition, you're effectively saying you can't change the way that we've been doing things. Or in effect, the last great change that we've had in the evolution of Jewish practice was this code freeze. I mean, for generations, what Judaism thought was, what Judaism practice was, had evolved. Evolved might even be a bad term because that implies, you know, that it's going in a certain sort of progression, but certainly it adapted based on locale. It adapted based on a whole lot of factors. And this was an adaptation of, we're stopping right now. So I think that's why you see the specific chadash asur min haTorah.
When would you date the code freeze?
Tzelech Sam Sofer. Meaning with this very statement, when people started saying, you can't change anything anymore. And that's kind of how Herzog even set it up, that most of what we would consider the, you know, ultra-Orthodox positions can be traced back to the ideology of the Chassam Sofer. Even if, you know, they don't follow Chassam Sofer consistently, halachically, that same attitude towards change and innovation can be dated back to Chassam Sofer. Alright? Does that answer the question?
Well, there's more, but I don't...
Okay.
the hour.
Sure.
Eger, in contrast, was even willing to accept as sweeping a change as political emancipation for the Jews, when he thought that its positive side outweighed the problems it created. It seems that this was partly due to a more utilitarian approach, in which he considered each change in society and its specific ramifications, rather than focusing on ideological battles, as did the Chatam Sofer.
Yeah. Right. So that's a very important consideration to make, and we're going to revisit that point towards the end. That very line in terms of what was his attitude from a practical perspective as opposed to utilitarianism versus ideology. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit later about what might have caused Rabbi Akiva Eger to have one position as and Chassam Sofer to have another. All right, continue.
It would appear that the differences between the two figures can be discerned in Eger's letter in Ela Divrei HaBrit, as well as in other writings related to reform. One of the foci of his polemic against Reformed Jews was that they did not accept the authority of the oral law as written in the Talmud. What is interesting is how he expressed the problem he had with such a theological position. A person who questions, this is a quote,
yeah.
A person who questions the words of the Talmud certainly does not don tefillin, phylacteries, and desecrates the Sabbath, since from where will he know that it, tefillin, is worn between the scalp and the forehead and not between the eyes? From where will he know what acts are forbidden on the Sabbath? End quote. Indeed, Eger attacked Reformed Jews' lack of faith, but he seems to have been particularly concerned with the practical ramifications that their approach entailed. The most pressing problem with reform was that it led to a lifestyle that was no longer characterized by halachic observance.
Yeah. Any thoughts on this?
Well, if I go into a synagogue and I want to join a minyan for chakras, I would bring tefillin, even though I'm not too... I don't have too much stock in my belief in the oral Torah.
Mm-hmm.
I would do it because I don't want to stand out like a sore thumb.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. So you don't really have to believe in the oral Torah to follow the halacha. Just follow it, even though you think it's baloney.
Mm-hmm. And thus,
I mean, partly it touches on a huge area that I don't think we should get into. But
well, it's up to you.
This is the opportunity to do it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. There's the whole issue why I'm not Orthodox, really, is I see a freeze as having taken place hundreds and hundreds of years earlier than you did.
Oh.
And the attitude, well, you can't change this unless you have the same level court or higher. We're never going to get that level court.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, it's sort of like if Americans had been overrun by some other country and a group of people took the code that existed in 1950 overseas with them and continued to observe it for 600 years.
Yeah, there was a Star Trek episode like that. You're going back to the Constitution. Star Trek, the original series, if anyone's keeping track. Forgot the name of the episode. When they were just relying on... Yeah, anyway.
So, that's my big objection.
Okay.
My smaller question is how does... it led to a lifestyle that was no longer characterized by halachic observance.
Yeah.
Well, so that's similar to the Chatam Sofer.
Okay. So let's answer, you know, point one, which I think is a really wonderful and certainly, you know, legitimate question, especially how it plays into here. There is a judicial legal system in halacha of you need at Beit Din Gadol B'Chokhmah Gadol B'Minyan, a bigger and better Beit Din, in order to overturn the legislations of the Gemara. Now, in terms of the opposition that people might have to certain practices, most of those, and I mean, I haven't done a survey, so actually by me using the term most might be irresponsible. Let me rephrase that. Many innovations, many's a little bit, it's a better vague term. Many of these sorts of innovations are, you know, that people would have objections to, do not contradict the Gemara. Give one example just even from last week. Women laying the Megillah for men is explicitly permitted by the rabbinic sources, or at least by the Mishnahs, the Tosefta that says no. And the reason why people don't is because, you know, they people will follow the Tosefta that says women have an obligation to not to read the Megillah, but to listen to the Megillah, right? But if you want to say, well, we're following the Mishnah, like, that's in the Gemara. The fact that people don't has nothing to do with the religious system, or at least the halachic system set up by the sages, as much as what turned in afterwards, right? So there you could actually believe in what the sages say, believe in what the sages say literally, and come up with a very different conclusion than what everyone else has done. Another example, ordaining women rabbis today. Another big issue. I'm in the middle of an article, reading someone's article on that. You know, to say, does it outright violate a Jewish law? Matter of dispute. You don't have in the Gemara anything that explicitly says that a woman is disqualified from receiving smicha. Assuming also today that no rabbi, Orthodox, conservative, former, reconstructionist, or other, right, the triangle rabbi certainly doesn't mean today what it did back then. So no one here has the halachic distinction of rabbi that once did. So calling someone a title in terms of having a position of, you know, well, some sort of authority. Well, Dvorah, you know, was a shofetet. Now you can say, well, maybe that was overturned later. But there's a lot more that if you follow straight Gemara that you could say would be acceptable from a halachic perspective that for various social reasons we don't. We'll see a little bit when we get to Rav Moshe and some others about saying mechitza. You don't have a source in the Gemara that says men and women, when they daven, have to be separated by a physical barrier. Right? So when other people say you need this mechitza, right, they could be basing it on some halachic logic, but that doesn't mean that the Sanhedrin actually said here's what you have to do. So as far as it being frozen back then, it is and it isn't. I mean, there's a lot more open that is neither commanded that you have to do it, nor prohibited, such that you would have a theoretical option. You could do this if you wanted to, but you don't have to. That due to various, you know, cultural, other sociological reasons, the community is kind of restricted, or, you know, force people to do things that weren't necessarily required. So that's not an intrinsic, you know, issue with the Gemara itself, as much as what people have done with the Gemara in subsequent generations. So that's to address point one. To address point two, it kind of goes back to what Ed was saying, is that according to the ideology of the Chassam Sofer, as quoted here, is if you reject, if you don't accept the authority of the oral laws written in the Talmud, that's Herzinger's line, then by a logical necessity, you're not going to be keeping halacha. Today, we know that this isn't necessarily the case, because it's very easy to do things that you don't believe. You know, I know that we've had some people who've come to shul who don't believe in God, yet they still come to shul. So, you know, there's nothing stopping you from it, or if you're going to do it, if you're going to decide to do something, here's how you're going to do it. Or you could still know, I mean, he's a sort of assuming a certain degree of intellectualism, that people have actually made a conscious decision that I'm going to reject the oral law, and or at least conceptually the oral law, and therefore I'm not going to practice it. Whereas people can just as easily say, you know what, I don't accept the authority of Chazal, but I'm going to do this anyway. Or you could say, I think Chazal, you know, this is all anachronistic, but I'm still going to keep up with this. Or more akin, using the language of Zacharia Frankel, right, where you could theoretically, you know, say, well, even though this might not matter anymore, it's important to do it for Jewish culture and whatnot. That sort of nuance doesn't seem to enter into Rabbi Akiva Eger's thought. Now, it could very well be that wasn't his experience in terms of that wasn't how people were operating, that if you rejected the oral, like, we've had, you know, significant time, you know, well over, you know, almost 200 years, right, to sort of deal with more of a nuanced approach to observance and modernity. He might not have had such nuance in his day, right? So I think that even this very distinction here about, you know, the assumption, or at least the logical conclusion, that if you have a certain ideological position, it will inevitably lead you to improper or no practice at all, is fascinating. Either this is actually what he observed, or it is a certain attitude with that he is approaching the questions of reform, or lack of a better term, reform or more academic type of ideology.
I wanted to throw in what you said, Dan, rang a bell, like the days of Rosh Chodesh.
Yeah.
We don't need witnesses and all this nonsense. We've got it on the calendar. And we're waiting for a based in, or a, whatever you call it, a large group of which we can't dissemble.
Mm-hmm.
I just privately observed the one that I want to observe.
Well,
and shut my mouth about the rest of it.
Truth is, even if, you know, there were a based in today, they probably wouldn't overturn it. How do I know? Because that very question came up in the time of the Gemara, and they made a conscious decision not to overturn it. Even in the time of the Gemara, keeping a Yom Tov Sheni wasn't as... the reasons behind keeping Yom Tov Sheni no longer exist. And we were talking before about Batel Tam Batel Gezerah, but we put the recorder on, so that's a good example of where they said Batel Tam Eino Batel Gezerah. The reason goes away, then, you know, the halacha, just because the reason goes away doesn't mean we're going to stop doing it, as opposed to other things like dancing on Shabbos and Yom Tov, where people will argue the reason the Gemara gives, and people will make up things, oh, there's a difference if it was built into the reason or not, and try to, you know, really split hairs to harmonize inconsistent practices with the Gemara, or at least inconsistent practices and ideology.
But I don't think you answered me. And my question was, how does this quote make him less stringent than...
This on its own doesn't. Here. It's only one, yeah, one statement here.
Okay.
Here's where we get to the other ones. Dr. Rayaran, care to take for us source number two, or paragraph number two?
Ooh.
Yeah.
If the ruling that a Jew should acquit Aaron as an apostate to Christianity, to treat him as a Jew for the purposes of the root, and to take a lenient approach, maintaining his status as an Israelite, just as regarding divorce and marriage.
All right, to explain here what the halachot are, if you have a Jew that shares a courtyard with a non-Jew, or if it's a Jew who's by himself amongst only non-Jews, he doesn't need an eruv at all. Whereas if there's another Jew in the courtyard, he would need to make an eruv with that other Jew. So the question is, let's say you had an apostate to Christianity, do you actually have to make an eruv with him, or do you assume he's no longer Jewish, treat him as not Jewish for the purposes of eruv, and you don't need to make an eruv? That's the halakha question, and he ruled you still hold him as a Jew just like you would for divorce and marriage. So here's all right. So Dr. Bayern, continue please.
So that meant that he could make it?
Not that he could, but that he'd have to. In a way, this is a chumrah. This is in a way, you're saying, yes, he's part of the Jewish community, but it leads to a stringency, or stringency is a bad term here, but it makes it a little more difficult for the person who's asking the question, as opposed to just saying, yeah, treat him as a non-Jew and carry. All right? He's saying, no, guy's Jewish, you still have to make an eruv. Or if you don't make an eruv with him, because he's eno modeh be'eruv, at the very least, what you would need to have is schirat reshut. You would need to rent from him the rights of access in order to be able to carry. Because since he is a apostate, he won't be able to be mitzaref, he wouldn't be able to join in, but you would have to do a tikkun, you would have to at least address his access rights in order to be able to carry. So, continue.
Okay. So, however, in a similar case, would have been apt to consider the apostate as a non-Jew regarding common property. Whereas regarding marriage and divorce, it was acquiesced to the overwhelming majority of authorities who recognized the Jewishness of the apostate. Here, he would not have done so.
Right, so Chassam Sofer in this case, as opposed to say divorce and marriage, right, he might have said that he still would be Jewish for those purposes, but Chassam Sofer probably here would have said, no, the purposes of Eruv, he wouldn't be considered Jewish, so the guy wouldn't need to worry about him at all. So Eger, in contrast,
seems to focus here on enabling the observant Jewish neighbor to keep the laws of Shabbat with greater ease. This example is consistent with the following description written by his sons in their biography of their father. Notwithstanding his great personal piety and meticulousness in all things, even so in his halachic renderings he was as lenient as possible. Often he permitted that which no other rabbi would allow. So I haven't been following why this ruling of Akiva Eger's is more lenient.
I think it would be considered more lenient in the sense that even though the person converted out, you still treat him as Jewish. I mean, it depends on what side you're coming at it from.
The ramifications for the person who's asking the question.
Yeah, in terms of being able to keep the laws of Shabbat with greater ease. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that line. I mean, that's Furtziger's line. I don't get that piece. But
you're saying if the guy sharing the courtyard is treated as a Jew.
Yeah,
greater obligations.
I would disagree with this one sentence, which is Furtziger's analysis of the halacha. That's not Rabbi Akiva Eger as much as, you know, when he says Eger seems to. So I'll leave that open. I mean, also, I haven't read the Tshuva inside, so we might elaborate in other ways in terms of, you know, why it would be so important
right,
here.
Right.
But, you know, the fact that even though you would consider him, you know, as a non-Jew, he's still treating him like, no, treat him as a Jew in this case, whereas his son-in-law, the Chassam Sofer, probably would have been more stringent. Yeah.
No.
I thought you had a question.
No, sorry. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Take number three.
Regarding Jews who deviated in practice but maintained a strong Jewish identification, Eger was extraordinarily accepting. Sometimes this was done even at the cost of making a strict ruling that caused difficulties for more committed Jews. In one important statement, he discusses the reliability of a witness where the witness had been accused of having his beard shaved regularly with a razor by a non-Jewish barber.
Right. So you have someone, you know, is this person trustworthy when you know, or at least you have testimony, that this person does not keep the biblical prohibition of ta'ar, of shaving with a straight razor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he's clearly breaking a Jewish law.
Except he can wiggle out of it by saying, I didn't cut my beard with a razor, the barber did.
Gemara talks about that, actually, is, you know, something you're still held responsible Yeah. It's a great point you raise. Gemara deals with that. So here's a quote from Rabbi Akiva Eger. And well, this is one that is really going to require some explanation here.
Thus one can, you want to read it?
No, you read. Go ahead.
Thus one can argue that shaving with a razor, which is spread due to our sins among so many, was not considered by him, the transgressor, to be such a forbidden act, for it is not apparent to people that it is forbidden. Therefore, since in our days the plague is spread, even among those who are careful in other areas, it appears to them, those who observe the behavior of the careful ones, that it's not so forbidden.
Wow. What do you think?
Picking on, you know, like it's nitpicking to me.
How is it nitpicking?
Well, I would let the guy slide and say he didn't shave his beard with a razor. The barber did, then no problem.
Right. Well, assuming, you know, that it is actually a prohibition, he's, I would say, the exact opposite of nitpicking. He's, in fact, letting it slide for another reason, in that he's sort of ascribing it, instead of saying that he's doing it the mazid, that he is breaking biblical law because he wants to break biblical law, it's, well, maybe he just doesn't think it's forbidden. Which is a really phenomenal type of leniency. Almost like a tinok shenishba, if you will. Mm-hmm. Where you have someone who's raised in captivity, doesn't really know that they're Jewish. He doesn't even recognize that it's prohibited. And he sort of ascribes, I mean, there's a great deal of, projection. Or assuming, if not mind reading, of what's going through.
It's a very much subjective standard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much based on social context.
Yes.
Yeah. And the implicit idea is that these rules apply when basically everybody is doing it right,
mm-hmm.
and somebody who's violating this is excluding
So when you say these rules, you know, to fill in the blank, it's not that these rules involving shaving, but these rules of the criteria by which we exclude people only make sense when people really know what they're doing. Right? And it's not like, oh, you know, we're doing it because everyone is, and therefore it's okay. You find something like that even in a Gemara, actually, as mentioned before, on the
right,
whole
he's
dancing.
He's not saying, oh, I see that most of my fellow Jews are shaving, so I can too. I didn't
right.
mean to imply that.
Exactly. But he is
the
saying.
The rule to determine how someone is invalidating, another person is invalidating himself.
Mm-hmm. To give another.
Depends on the extent to which it deviates.
It deviates from the social norms, or how much are they conditioned to think that it's okay.
Yeah.
To give a parallel based on the dancing and clapping, when the Gemara discusses it in Beitza Daf Lamed, part of the context is, you know, there are these people who are doing this, and you're not saying anything. You're not giving them mussar. You're not telling them that they're doing something wrong. And the response was, mutaf yishogigim ba'al yehu mizidin. Better that they sin in error rather than sin intentionally. Because if you go up and you tell someone that this is prohibited, they're not going to listen to you because they're not, you know, either, you know, it's, they're not accustomed to doing so. Today, you know, you'll find like, oh, you know, we'll come up with some sort of lumpus, and people don't realize that it still is in fact forbidden because the Beis Din didn't actually overturn it, right? So you don't say, you know, it's like, you're not saying that it's okay. You're saying, well, just because you break this law doesn't necessarily mean you deny the entire rabbinic system, or at least certainly not on a lay level, right? We're not talking, say, about leaders here. We're not talking about the heads of, you know, Reform Judaism. You're talking about random guy, Pashta Yid. Whereas if you're talking about someone who ideologically rejected Torah Shabbat, as he said earlier, that might be grounds for a little bit certain more types of exclusion, because that would inevitably lead you to. In other words, there could be a difference between whether or not you're actively seeking out the da'at and the mazid and intentionally, you know, seeking to change and break Jewish law versus you just simply don't know any better.
I was just thinking that if you approach the guy who doesn't know any better and tell him, he may start thinking, you know, you're right, and come to think of it, the whole Talmudic system doesn't make sense. So you turn him into somebody much worse.
Right. Alternatively, you can just say, well, you know, if everyone is doing it, well, how could it possibly be wrong?
Yeah.
Right? And then he just wouldn't take it seriously. And the truth is, that is exactly a mentality that people have today, which is, you know, when you say what this group of Jews is doing, how could they be wrong? They're so from. Could they be doing? One of my I think I mentioned this at one point, not in this series, but one of my favorite responsa is Rambam on standing for the Aseret Dibrot. Where one of the in the letter, one of the rationales given is a rabbi in a community wanted to change the then practice of the synagogue, which was not to stand for the reading of the Ten Commandments. He said, "Stand for the Ten Commandments because they do it in Baghdad." At which point Rambam says, the fact that they do it in Baghdad isn't a proof at all, because if we found sick people in Baghdad, we wouldn't make ourselves sick just so we should all be equal, but rather we try to heal them. You know, but this type of social thing is like, you know, well, other people are doing it and therefore it's okay, just from a social perspective. You know, it, you can understand how people would think that way, right? Whether or not it's correct or not. And he seems to be giving a certain dispensation, but not from the perspective of, you know, he's okay in terms of breaking Jewish law, but he hasn't reached that level where we need to exclude him even internally. Forget the fact that it's not that you're not treating him as a non-Jew, but you're also not treating him as an internal outsider, for lack of a better term. Yeah.
I wanted to throw in this guy I ran across, older fellow, he talking about shaving with an electric shaver. He says, oh no, you got to go to a special guy in Chinatown that I go to. He knows how to set the electric shaver so that it's kosher.
Yeah, we
and
spoke
I thought
about
to myself, this guy's crazy.
We spoke about that a couple of weeks ago. So I don't want to repeat the whole thing on thing on the shaving, but I know we discussed that on one of the tapes here. Tapes. I still see tapes that, of course, I have it. Yeah. Anyway.
Do you dial people?
I still said idiomatically. It's like, oh yeah, you dial in. Like, no, I haven't dialed in in God as long. Anyway. Here's another really fascinating case. Regarding a Moel who didn't keep Shabbat, his opinion was far more permissive. Not only did he validate circumcisions that were performed in the past, he allowed this person to continue to act as the Moel of the town. First, Eger cited the opinion that one who only transgressed rabbinic prohibitions does not attain the status of a mumar, a rebel, regarding the entire Torah, who is unable to circumcise. So that's point one, but that assumes that whatever the Sabbath desecrator did was only on a rabbinic level. Moreover, a person is only considered a public Sabbath desecrator when, excuse me, he transgresses a prohibition in front of 10 Jews. Eger assumed, another operative word here of an assumption he's making, that the 10 Jews in front of whom the Mohel would most probably commit forbidden acts were, quote, friends who are like him. Since such a collection of Sabbath desecrators, he said, did not fulfill the halachic qualifications to render an act as Bifar Hesya, the desecration had to occur in front of, quote, 10 kosher Israelites, for when it is in front of 10 mumarim, 10 rebels, regarding the entire Torah, it appears that this is not a quorum of 10 Jews at all.
Sorry, Rabbi, now I'm going to ask you.
There are plenty of things here.
I
go for it.
Do this.
Not a problem.
That's what I like.
Please identify the precise logical fallacy.
You want me?
In this reasoning.
It seems somewhat apparent what the logical fallacy is. You're basically saying this guy himself isn't considered a mumar, rebel to the entire Torah, because the only people that he would do it in front of would be 10 other people who are themselves mumar.
Exactly.
Which means the only reason why you don't exclude this guy is because you've already excluded 10 other people, at least. All of his friends.
All of his friends.
Right. Yeah. It's really wonderful. It really is. It is a great pick up there. So on one end, you can say he was recognized the cognitive dissonance. For another analogy behind this, I shouldn't say you find this. I saw this once in Islamic law, and I got this off of a secondary source. So if there are any experts in Islamic law, please correct me on this. One of the issues that comes up is gang rape, where you have a woman who, say, is raped. The burden is on her to prove that someone else raped her. But the only way that she can do that is by bringing in two upstanding witnesses. But by definition, if you have two bystanders who didn't do anything to help her while she was being raped, then therefore she must not be upstanding, which means it wasn't raped by Islamic law, and therefore she's held liable if she was married at the time for having an affair. And it's kind of in a weird way like here, of the only people who can testify against this person would be illegitimate. It's really fascinating. Yeah, any thoughts worth elaborating on this
one? I like the sophistication of the guy who, this is Egger.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, look, he probably hangs out with guys that are holding meckle and getting, cutting corners, so can't hang him for it.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm just thinking about permitting Agunot to marry again by invalidating their original marriage.
Yeah.
That it's sort of the same thing. You're really pulling. And maybe he did it because there was no other Moel for that town.
Well, let's consider motivations in a second. That's a great point there. We'll consider about the motivation for why would he take a different approach. Right, so let's hold off on that question. I think this is worth staying on just for a little bit longer. That he needs 10 at the same time that you bring in one, you're pushing away 10 others. Not necessarily by name, but almost by association, that each one is going to, at the same time, invalidate and legitimize the other. If you remember the source that I sent you about the three Sifrei Torah, where two of them invalidated the third.
Right.
So each one was necessary for both proving the legitimacy of one and
sure.
Yeah, it's the logic that he went into this was clear that he was trying to be lenient in this case, even though Rabbi Akiva Eiger was a very smart individual, knew what he was doing.
It seems to bolster the famous, now famous statement, where there's a will, there's a halachic way.
Rabbinic will, halachic way, yeah. Then you can seem like trying to reach behind. But if you think about it from the other side, about to really treat someone as Mechalel Shabbat v'Farhesia, a good question is how do you know? And let's say there were. And don't forget that this is based on an assumption.
Yeah.
Right? And this is a lot of assuming. So even if you want to take it a matter of a suffake, and there's a whole slew of laws in Yeridea about suffakes, like what to do when you don't know something, rule number one is, if you don't know, you find out the answer. Right? Move on. And this is just based on, a fairly significant, assumption. It's really mind-blowing, just, that he took this position. So I think at this point we have seen certain cases of the Chasam Sofer taking at least a slightly more lenient approach. Rabbi Akiva Eiger taking a slightly more lenient approach when it comes to excluding another Jew, where he does seem, at least in what we have here, source number four, at bending over backwards to include this individual. So let's talk now about the question of motivations. And let's talk about not just the motivations of why. Two questions. One, why was Rabbi Akiva Eiger lenient? And I think in this case it would be an objective leniency. And the other, why would he be more lenient relative to the Chasam Sofer? Or alternatively, why would the Chasam Sofer be more stringent in such matters of exclusion than Rabbi Akiva Eiger? So you have introduced one point of pragmatism. Explain.
Oh, well, I mean, like I said, it's possible that there was no other Moel available for the town, and they would be put in an impossible situation.
Okay.
I was also wondering, he was the father-in-law. Does that mean that the stuff that he decided and wrote preceded his son-in-law's stuff? I mean, would that be an issue? That reform became a greater threat as time progressed, and his
point number two
had to react.
Fantastic, and we'll elaborate that in a bit. So the first one is simple pragmatism. If someone's the only mohel in the town, what would you rather have? No mohel at all, or have a mohel or a brit milah done by someone who theoretically, is still Jewish? I mean, the only way you would, push him off is if you say, he's a mumar l'chol haTorah kula, right? So you'd have to use a fairly significant point of exclusion, but you're doing so at this point to the detriment of the community, cutting the nose to spite the face, so to speak. Right? So that's one side of pragmatism. Any other ideas on the question of why Rabbi Akiva Meir might have been more lenient in an objective stance?
Not on that. That's a different question for you.
Well, we'll get to the other question. So one other thing that we saw with the Chassam Sofer.
What does a guy's frumkeit have to do with his ability to perform a moral procedure? Nothing.
That goes back to things that we saw months ago about different types of rebellious people. You tend to, as a general law, accept people in Judaism for whatever it is that they accept. Meaning, if someone believes in minyan, you accept him for minyan. Someone doesn't keep kosher, is a mumar l'tayavon, you don't trust his kashrus, but you can still count him for minyan.
Right.
If someone rejects the entire Torah or the equivalent thereof, then you can't treat, even if you treat him as Jewish in one sense, you can't rely on him for any other mitzvot, because it's as if he rejected the entire Torah by analogy. Shabbat in public is one of those things where if you break Shabbat in public, it is as if you have removed yourself from the Jewish community.
Mm.
All right, so that would explain that question there. Another one that we mentioned is from a utilitarian perspective. Where can you achieve the greatest good? It could have been that for Rabbi Akiva Eger, for the two reasons. One, his perception or his attitude or his personal disposition that if you push these people aside, you will actually cause more harm than good on a general level, but rather you want to try to keep people as included in the Jewish parsha, so to speak, as much as you can. And we saw with Chassam Sofer even last week, the distinction he made about whether or not you can save the children. Right, so there was a certain pragmatism Chassam Sofer had. Dan raised a phenomenal point that, you know, it's been a recurring theme. It could just as equally be that, you know, Chassam Sofer living a generation, Rabbi Akiva Eger living a generation before Chassam Sofer, didn't view Reform Judaism as big of a threat.
Yeah.
So for Rabbi Akiva Eger, he could say, well, either, and this could either be due to chronology, in that, you know, he came for some Reform Judaism evolved. It could also be based on geography in terms of his own, you know, Dalet Amot in his own community, what he observed, right? But it could have just been his response to the threat was like, well, it's not as big of a deal as someone who doesn't keep Shabbos performs a Brit Milah. Chassam Sofer, based on either, again, it could be his personal disposition. And you cannot divorce someone's personality from their decisions. You have some rabbis who are very hot-headed. You have some rabbis who are very much more even-keel. I did not know the Chassam Sofer personally. I don't know how you would categorize him. Sometimes there would be a personal disposition about how you strategically operate. But also, you could just as easily argue, in a later generation, he saw Reform Judaism as a much greater threat to the long-term viability of Judaism, which meant he could have felt that he needed to be a lot more stringent in terms of where you set the boundary lines than Rabbi Akiva Eger, from a different sense of pragmatism. And that's not even assuming the ideology, meaning it could also just very well be that Rabbi Akiva Eger and Chassam Sofer just simply disagreed on how to handle it. You could disagree on the halacha in terms of, you know, how, and you can disagree on how do you apply it. You can disagree on the mitziyut. What is the reality in front of you? And there are whole, so it could very well have been that Chassam Sofer, living as a contemporary, like year for year as Rabbi Akiva Eger, might have just as easily said the exact same thing. Right? Or Rabbi Akiva Eger, you know, living, you know, let's say a few decades after he did, might theoretically could have said the exact same thing as Chassam Sofer. They were responding to very different, I shouldn't say very different, but you had different people responding to whatever it is that they saw. But it does seem that Rabbi Akiva Eger certainly, for his opposition to the reform, certainly didn't seek out reasons to exclude people. I mean, for all of his questions of, you know, you have a lot of seems, you have a lot of assumptions, that he doesn't seem to actually go out to try to get a definitive answer to. Which means you may be able to imply he didn't want an answer. And he would rather be dan l'chafzechut, would rather give people the benefit of the doubt, because he just didn't want to exclude people. And, you know, to explain like the disposition thing, I don't say that as a matter of one person is better or not than the other. I just don't think that you can necessarily remove someone's personality from the equation based on how they're raised, because it does come out. And you see that today. You have certain rabbis whose disposition is just a lot more welcoming, accept people in, you know, whatever, and you've got other people who are, we need to get it right, and you have to conform. In the language of Kiruv, I'm not sure if you gave this analogy before, the difference between a Noach and an Avraham, where Noach built an ark and Avraham had an open tent. Right? Sometimes you can think it's, you know, people have the same personality, just have different strategies. Sometimes people just, you know, operate differently. Is one objectively better or worse than the other? Not necessarily, and it's harder to say in hindsight because, again, it's hard for us today to put ourselves in their position of being faced with really drastic changes, unprecedented changes to Judaism. By unprecedented changes, I mean you're now being faced not with Judaism competing with Christianity, you have Judaism competing against non-Judaism. Or a, for lack of a better term, a watered-down Judaism, or a different form of Judaism that you didn't really have as much, and they were still sensitive to, well, you know, this is what happened with Shabtai Tzvi, you know, which we saw last week is still permeating the thought of it, and you still had a couple of people, you know, out there. You know, it's easy for us today, after 200 years of learning how to navigate, you know, these two extremes. In their day, they didn't have that advantage, and you're trying to predict what's going to be, you know, it's clear that, you know, not all of the doomsaying prophecies came true. I mean, some did, you know, I don't say some did, but, you know, certain prognostications, you can argue, did come true, and not everything. I mean, you see, you can go to college and still be from. It is possible. You know, just be, and again, largely because we've had a lot of time to build up on this. But, yeah.
Two points. One is really just a footnote.
Sure.
That Aviva Avi's grandson became a chassid.
Ah! Okay.
Rabbi Leibowitz. And there's some very funny stories about how they sucked him in.
Mm.
I don't recall details and have never studied in detail, but in teaching this period, the dispute of contrast between Rabbi Akiva Eiver and Rabbi Yonasan and Eivushitz is very often taught. You have thoughts on whether that's pertinent to this question of strategies of exclusion? I mean, the general impression that I retain is Rabbi Akiva Eiver is presented as more accommodating to changes and
I guess.
And Eivushitz is like more conservative and more of a mystic.
Okay. If there's any discussion, I don't have much more to add. Yeah.
I was just thinking, going back to the razor thing.
Yeah.
That what he seems to be presenting is an argument in favor of the principle of Mara Zion. That he says, okay, some of my congregants know of a way to shave their beards that's halachically permissible.
Hmm.
But they, now that they walk around with clean shaven, other people look at them and say, oh, it must be okay to shave.
Were you here at the Mara Zion Shear?
No.
That's its own shear. Yeah, it was, I guess we can call it PR, you know, for BR before recording. But yeah, Halakha of Mara Zion gets its own separate topic there.
But isn't he, in fact, implicitly making that argument?
I don't think so.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I got something, a puzzle for you guys. For some reason, it's...
Okay, then. So that would be it for some Sofer Rabbi Akiva Eiger. We'll, I guess, conclude with this time period next week. And then we'll get to Pesach. And then after Pesach, we will continue with more modern-day Tshuvot and to see how, you know, certain responses with not just reform, but also conservative, which is its whole other issue. Okay, have a wonderful week.